Hello, and welcome to this episode of Data Unchained. The paradigm for data access has changed. Data allows businesses to build products faster, make more informed decisions, increase both revenues and profits. Yet in today's decentralized world, getting data to the remote workers, the distributed applications, and the artificial intelligence engines is a challenge. Data Unchained, this podcast, digs into the challenges and the solutions to make data a globally accessible resource. I'm your host, Molly Presley. And for this episode, I want to send a thank you to Michael Cornwell, field CTO over Pure Storage, for recommending Doug as one of our guests. So let's get started with introducing Doug Laney. Doug, would you take just a minute and talk a bit about your background and maybe a little bit about the books that led to inviting you here to the podcast?
Sure. Thanks, Molly. Thanks for having me. Well, currently I'm a data strategy innovation fellow with the consultancy West Monroe based out of Chicago. We're a national firm that specializes in digital products and services. Developing them for our clients. My focus is really helping to develop new offerings around data valuation, data monetization, data strategy, helping clients with that, and continuing to do some speaking and writing and teaching on the topic as well. So prior to West Monroe, I was with the Gartner, had a long career with Gartner as a senior industry analyst focusing on big data and analytics strategy. Started my career in the Big Eight. and then did some time with some early stage artificial intelligence or expert systems firms.
It's really great to have you on, and I'm going to promote your latest book here for a minute, Data Juice, if you're on video for any of our listeners. I know that Douglas has done some speaking events at both vendor events as well as really evangelizing to end users and businesses about how they can really put their data to work and the benefit of doing that. And that's what we'll spend some time talking about in this podcast. But definitely check out Data Juice. Great stories is actually, I wouldn't typically say this, but it's actually good evening reading. It's not too heavy. It's a lot of fun, but it's also on a pretty important and technical topic. So really fun book to check out. And then our other guest, David Flynn. David is a visionary in how access to data has evolved over the years. First, with the technical vision for what Pure Storage did, bringing NVMe and really high performance memory into systems to be able to provide higher performance. But then, as I've talked with David many times in the past, in fact, I work for him, so I get plenty of opportunity to talk to David. Thinking about really in today's decentralized world, how do we make data available where it's needed? So David, you're a great visionary. Would you maybe just give us a quick introduction about your thoughts on this idea of making data available globally?
Well, as you pointed out, I was the founder of the company Fusion.io that helped move the world away from mechanical hard drives to flash. In a sense, backwards a bit, because with flash, there's a tendency to want to put it more directly into the servers instead of aggregating it into massive centralized arrays. So I became keenly aware of the challenges of managing decentralized data, in this case, across scale-out architectures within a data center. But you have an even larger, similar challenge with managing decentralized data across whole data centers in support of a true model of cloud computing, of run anything anywhere without having to care about infrastructure concerns, and to enable the ability to have a geographically globally distributed workforce, which has become increasingly important in the modern world. So background has been at the lowest level with the media transition to flash and the protocols, buses, controllers that have evolved because of that. And then more recently with Hammer Space at the data layer with how you can have a single source of truth, a single file system that can live and exist across a fully decentralized environment.
Thank you both for joining the podcast. The first topic I'd like to delve into is you think about how industry has evolved over the last 10 years. We've introduced the cloud, And the cloud is infrastructure, it's applications, it's a different model of architecting IT systems. And then we've also introduced this concept of big data, that you can analyze data and data sets to drive insights much quicker than a human brain could. So maybe first we could just talk a little bit about, how do you see paradigms have shifted in data access and data architecture over the last 10 years? What kind of challenges are people encountering? What kind of paradigms need to shift for today?
So let's go back to, I guess, the definition of how big data is defined. Back in when I was an analyst with Gartner, we realized that organizations were challenged with not only the growing size of data, particularly due to e-commerce and the internet, evolving in the late 90s and early 2000s, but and everybody was talking about big data in kind of terms of growing the size of data. But what we realized is that there were three facets to the challenge, and that was the growing speed of data as well, the velocity, and then also the range of data sources that were being created and potentially useful to an organization. So I first characterized those back in the late 90s or around 2000 as the kind of the three V's challenge of volume, velocity, and variety that a lot of people today use to kind of define big data. So, but we need to see them not only as challenges, but also as opportunities. So today I'm kind of focused more on the opportunistic side, David probably more on dealing with the challenges of big data. And, I see that organizations that bring in a greater variety of data into their analytic environments are the ones that are really thriving today. Those that are dealing with high velocity data to make more real time kinds of decisions and operational optimizations are the ones who are thriving as well. Not just those that are, have a database or a cloud environment that's bigger than their competitors.
It's interesting how those things compound to make the challenge of working with the data even more difficult. It'd be one thing if all you were doing was statically storing a large amount of data, but to have the amount of data times the rate at which you need to process it, and then all of the different sources, that's these things definitely add up to make it a bigger challenge. And I think in some ways we're running with that headlong into other macro challenges like the slow death of Moore's Law and the challenge of getting the silicon scaling that we were used to. With that, we no longer have the crutch that we used to of hardware supporting software being able to be sloppy.
So we've seen the kind of introduction of a new role in a lot of organizations called the chief data officer. Is that something, maybe Doug, as you think about the businesses you work with and the stories you tell, are you seeing that as pretty commonplace or a role that more organizations just who are getting started on big data initiatives are starting to invent?
Definitely becoming more commonplace. In fact, in some industries, a chief data officer is being mandated in some government organizations as well. So here's kind of another, it intersects with another trend, which is that there was a day in which applications and data had to be inexorably linked, co-located and managed as a single entity. Today, we're in a world, you mentioned the cloud, Molly, that we can move data into the cloud and separate it from the applications and the systems that process it. This has really enabled us to think about, and I wrote about this in my first book, Infonomics, about the ability to manage technology and data separately. As we start to manage data and information as a separate asset, it makes sense that we have a leader to drive that. And that's really what the role of the chief data officer is about, to kind of complement the technology side of the house and also represent that, the economy today is really driven by data. Many people call data the new oil, which reflects a macro perspective and a correct one, that data is a driver of the economy the way oil was a century ago. But data has unique economic qualities that oil doesn't have that make it potentially much more valuable and useful than oil. And the organizations that are taking advantage of those economic qualities are ones that are managing data as a separate asset, and have a chief data officer to do that. Now, the chief data officer role, we see kind of two kinds of chief data officers, one where they are in more of kind of a strategic role and advising, and really don't have an executive seat at the table or budgets or resources. And then there's kind of that's the CDO light. And then the actual C-level CDO is one that really has taken the control of the data assets and data related resources and staffing in the organization. And those are ones where we actually see those kinds of organizations doing more with their data than if they have just a CIO or a CDO light responsible for data assets.
I'm very familiar with the data as the new oil. I've used it myself. I found it incredibly insightful what you had to say about that in your book. You just touched on it a minute ago, but I'd love to delve into a little bit more of the things that make it so unique versus, oil.
Would you like me to give a thumbnail?
Yeah.
Sure. All right. So when you consume a drop of oil, consider that you can only consume it one way at a time, right? And when you consume a drop of oil, it gets used up. It dissipates. It turns into heat and energy and pollution, pollutants. So you can't use it again. And that when you consume a drop of oil, it doesn't create more oil. Now, think about that in terms of data. A unit of data you can use multiple ways simultaneously. A piece of data you can use over and over again, and as long as it is relevant. And when you use data, typically we're in a position to capture more data about wherever and whenever, data is used. And so data is what economists would call a non-rivalrous, non-depleting, progenitive asset. And oil doesn't have any of those characteristics. So again, the companies that are thriving today are those that are taking advantage of those unique characteristics. There are also some other differences, like data ostensibly is cheaper to store and transport or transmit than physical assets are.
Can be transmitted electronically. You don't have to transmit it. That's something that I have often talked about, is that in the modern economy, as economies mature, become more specialized, they become more layered, and that data is the commodity that is being shipped across the supply chain of data between companies, whether it's the big major movie studios making movies and working with subsidiaries, or in the pharma world, drug research, or building aircraft and vehicles. All of these things, you now have whole ecosystems of companies that work together on it, and data is more and more the product going across this supply chain.
It's substituting for the classic factors of productivity. If you think about it, go back to your old econ classes, you learn about land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship as being the four factors of productivity. But increasingly, data is a substitute for those, and a much more efficient and cost-effective substitute. You think about companies that had to create massive inventories of product. Now, with the ability to forecast and have N-tier supply chain visibility, they don't have to keep as much product or materials on hand as they once did. So effectively, we're substituting data for product. And obviously, we're substituting data for land today. Right now, we're probably all working from our homes, and maybe, our offices aren't as big as they once were because a lot of people are working remotely or in hybrid environments. And so, yeah, it's become a substitute for the factors of production. I argue data should actually be a fifth factor of production.
That's really fascinating. When you think about data in more refined sense as information or knowledge, then that becomes very evident, right? As a pool of knowledge would seem to be very substantial to the improvement of productivity in things.
One of the items that I've noticed over the last few years has been that we see lots of marketing charts and analyst charts from companies like Gartner talking about the growth of unstructured data relative to structured data. And one of the challenges in this whole conversation is, I think we would all agree that the value of data has increased dramatically for all the reasons you've been discussing. But getting access to that data, especially this massive unstructured data, has proven to be a challenge. People know how to store it. They know how to archive it, protect it, secure it, but really putting it to use has been a challenge. And I think that as I read some of the stories in your books, Doug, and look at the companies on the unstructured data side that are being successful, they figured out ways to overcome this. But maybe, David, would you start with just talking a little bit about this concept of data gravity or getting data to applications and the challenges the industry has had with that, especially in these massive unstructured data environments?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have at the same time the industry has created cloud and cloud computing to finally kind of realize a utility model of computing. At the same time, the amounts of data that we're talking about, the three V's, have made it very difficult to truly live up to that potential of run anything anywhere. You end up having to do the processing at least in close proximity to where you have housed the data. And that means you're stuck in a specific region of the cloud. If I have put it in AWS East, then that's where it is and where I have to run it. And the fact that the cloud hasn't really lived up to that potential of run anything anywhere has become more and more evident with the macroeconomic disruptions, the supply chain challenges, the cost of energy. These things have driven up an awareness that, you know, if I have to do all of my processing in London, where, you know, where the locus of business operations are, I'm going to be paying 30-40% more than if I'm doing it in some place in rural Canada. You know, it's kind of like it's driving us to a realization that the long time adage of moving the processing to your data, that's the conventional wisdom, that is violated when you realize that the processing is the thing which is more tethered to the real world. You have to actually deploy silicon. You have to have it powered and cooled. It has to be plugged into the power grid. And so you have locality when it comes to where you process it, especially if it involves people and skills. So we need to be able to move the data to where you need to work with it, as opposed to the other way around.
And David, this has an impact also on edge computing. So as we have devices that are increasingly expected to be smart and both producing and consuming data, that has an impact on infrastructure and architecture and moving computing to out of the cloud.
That, yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that there's a real debate going on right now in the world of, anybody that's using high-end workstations like producing movies, animation, video games, you know, what are they to do? Put a workstation in everybody's home and manage the data all the way down to that, or use the cloud and virtual desktops and be able to run a virtual desktop in a cloud region nearby. But with that, you have to have, again, access to the source material data. And that's a real challenge because the data is localized in only one region of the cloud. So how do you support, you know, folks working from South Africa, India, or Australia in those things?
And then we haven't even talked about governance, like the residency requirements for data as well, especially for dealing with consumer, customer, you know, PII.
I definitely find when I talk about the shift in making data more accessible more broadly, often the first thing that comes up is, oh gosh, is this a security risk? Is this a governance compliance risk? And I think that's something everyone needs to think about. If I control my data as an IT administrator or as a scientist, and only I have access, that avoids a lot of those issues. And that definitely needs to be worked through as you think about this paradigm shift as well.
I think the existing world of managing data by copy, which seems to be kind of the only way that you can have data be locally resident at multiple points around the world, we take that as gospel that the only way to solve that is by copy. But if you're able to put the data behind the file system, behind the presentation layer, and have data management be done transparently behind the facade of that, then you finally open up the opportunity to solve that paradox of having data everywhere you need it without ever having copied it. And since you aren't copying it, you're keeping Pandora's box closed and are able to enforce the play. So, you know, at some point we have to empower something to automate the management and diffusion of data. And that thing has to be, I think, behind the data presentation layer, or else you'll get you won't truly be able to automate it if it fractures your view of the data in the very act of trying to manage it by copy. So we see that in the structured data world, it's much easier, I think. But in the unstructured data, it gets even more challenging.
David, I love what you mentioned about Pandora's box. You know, as I was looking at how other assets are managed, I came up with a set of generally accepted information principles. And one of those principles is around being economically circumspect every time you create a copy of data. Data is not only, it's not only gospel, but it's just easy to do, right? To create copies of data. And so we do it without giving a lot of thought to the implications on security, right? Every time you make a copy of data, you're increasing your attack surface. Every time you make a copy or move data, you're increasing the cost to synchronize that data. You're increasing the risk that if that data isn't synchronized, you're making inconsistent decisions or operating inconsistently. And so I think, you know, organizations need to be, again, more economically circumspect every time they're making a copy of data, whether it's into an Excel spreadsheet or whether it's into a data lake. So as far as unstructured data goes, I think my simple perspective on that is that you really can't do a lot with unstructured data until you structure it, you know, in some way, either virtually or actually. You can search it, you can look it up, you can read it, but to analyze it, you have to typically add some kind of structure to it, and whether that's tagging it or whatever. But there's really some great examples. Molly, you mentioned the book, and so yeah, there's some great examples that we've collected over the years of how organizations are generating really unique value from their unstructured data. One is from Lockheed Martin, who I spoke to, and they kind of took this idea of generating leading indicators for their projects. You know, we all use the kind of the standard project reporting method. We type up a status report, we send it to our managers, they aggregate the status report and type it up and send it up to their managers. I said, you know, what if you analyzed project communications, emails, communications, documents, to identify leading indicators of project issues like scope or budget or personnel or technology, and then surface those automatically. So that's what Lockheed did. And they claim they now have 3 times greater foresight into project issues with using less information than they used to, and are saving hundreds of millions of dollars a year on the product lines. I think they might have used it on the F-35 line, but I'm not sure where they've applied it. So there are a lot of really great examples, but again, until you structure data, until you train a system to look for certain things, then there's really not a lot you can do with unstructured data other than read it or look up things in it.
I definitely think that that's part of the innovation. Yeah, I mean, gosh, I've worked with SNIA, I've worked with IEEE, different standards group that they've struggled with of how do you create structure around unstructured data. David, maybe you can just talk about your idea of a metadata control plane as a solution to this.
There are lots of different sources for metadata. Metadata being, you know, one of the main ways we add some structure around the data. We have, I think, as an industry, failed to standardize the platform for that metadata to go along with it. I mean, we have file systems have existed since the dawn of operating systems, since the dawn of computing, never really had traction in metadata carrying along with that, besides the, you know, the file system level stuff of access controls and whatnot.
And there have been metadata standards groups for decades that really haven't got a lot of traction either.
And I think one of the this dovetails into the previous discussion, because we really need that metadata to be able to give data the empowerment to own its own existence, so that data can be in charge of how it's rendered, housed across the infrastructure, so that you're not doing it by copy, you're doing it by a declarative intent. The metadata becomes a mechanism for deriving or setting that declared intent that can drive the rationalization of where the data is housed from one point in time to the next. So we really need metadata as a platform to inform not just the use of the data, but to inform the management of the data.
And wouldn't it be great if the metadata was carried along with the data itself as it flowed through a information supply chain? But there's no standard way to do that today.
If the file system itself is decoupled from the infrastructure, has the enhanced metadata, and is able to span whole data centers and whole organizations, then the metadata stays singular while the data is managed rationally as to where all you're maintaining. And they aren't copies at that point. They become instantiations of the same piece of data instead of copies. Because a copy by sort of definition implies a fork of the metadata and a fork in time, which means you run into the merger thing. I was going to ask you something, Doug. In my watching the industry, it dawned on me that the challenge of managing the proliferation of copies, the merger problem, the data janitorial problem, is likely the largest challenge to, the many inefficiencies that come from copying, that really it's the manpower and the management side that would dominate in the notion of copy and merger kind of.
For sure, but also the infrastructure costs. You're doubling your cost every time you make a copy of data as well. So
that's true. I guess that can't be forgotten either. Yeah.
And those are the things we look at. We're actually working on several data valuation projects with clients, where we're helping them understand the value of their data as if it were a balance sheet asset, which of course, due to antiquated accounting practices, we don't value data as an actual asset on the balance sheet. Don't get me started. So those are some of the costs that we look at. We look at the labor costs involved in managing data. We look at the storage costs, the computing costs, and use that kind of on the denominator. But then, again, I'm trying to be focused more on the numerator side. What are the various ways that we can and should be using data in a multitude of ways to grow its return on investment?
When you talk to your these kinds of customers and you're thinking about these projects, Doug, how do they go about developing ideas and inspiration around data, ways they can squeeze value out of their data?
Yeah, so we recommend taking a product management approach to that. Yes, you can develop use cases and float them around. And yeah, that's what a lot of organizations do. But we think that you ought to take a more disciplined approach to having workshops periodically to generate hypotheses, to look at the extended business ecosystem of potential stakeholders for the data, users, consumers of the data, look at bringing in external data sources to augment and improve the value of your own data. And then we run various hypothesis generating exercises. We look at examples like those from my book, and I actually have a library of like 500 examples of how organizations are using data and analytics in innovative ways. And we use those to inspire or shame organizations into doing more with their data. A lot of clients will say, yeah, what are others in our industry doing with data? My flippant response to that is, why do you want to be in second place, right? Or third place? Why not look at what others in other industries are doing and try to copy that or leverage that idea in your own industry and be the first one to do so? There's some cool examples of that, like how the city of Los Angeles is using seismic prediction algorithms to predict where crimes are occurring. So you can look outside your industry for examples. Yeah. So wait, did I answer your question? I think I went down a rabbit hole there.
No, you went down a bit of a rabbit hole, but it was one I actually wanted to go to. So that's great. I think as we tie up, it would be great to talk about some of the success stories that organizations who have tackled this, instead of going from the older paradigms, that they've actually invested in, whether it's the chief data officer or somebody in the organization just gets the energy to say, hey, I'm going to really tackle this. I know that at one of the events that one of my colleagues here at Hammerspace was at recently, we had a customer say, who is one of our customer advocates, talking to a peer in his industry saying, if you don't make this shift to being able to use your data in this decentralized world, you'll be out of business in 2 or 3 years. And this was a customer saying it to his peer. But I think, you know, a few success stories of people who say, yeah, it's worth really engaging in a project like this would be interesting to hear from both of you, where you've seen customers really succeed or individuals.
Yeah, and I've heard this several times, but I remember the first time I heard it was the CIO of Hershey's told me, he's like, I'm trying to make the case to the rest of the executive team that, you know, we're a data company that just happens to make confections, right? So you were asking about the process. So I talked about the kind of the workshop, the ideation workshop. Then we take those ideas that are generated. Typically, we'll generate 40 to 70, you know, ideas, and then we obviously want to prioritize them. So we look at them from the perspective of their economic feasibility, operational, managerial, ethical, legal, various factors, and kind of plot that to see which ones are we should prioritize. And then we go into more of a market assessment. Like we actually interview the potential stakeholders or consumers of that data to find out how they would use it and what value they would get from it. How do they want that data packaged? We can package data in different ways as either an API or a pub sub model or analytics or integrated data. So we want to explore that. And then we need to think about the infrastructure and architecture. Do we have the ability to actually create that data product? And if not, we need to kind of deal with that. And then if we're really treating it as a product, which we should be, we need to think about the support and maintenance and, you know, versioning and all of that. So we go through that whole process with clients. But yeah.
Doug, I have some questions that I've been dying to ask. So if Molly doesn't mind, first, how impactful has deep learning or machine learning in general been in and around the space versus older mechanisms for leveraging data? How much of a revolution is it really in this world?
A couple of perspectives on that. You know, so I was doing AI work back in the, you know, early 90s. So what I see today isn't, you know, terribly different. We're just able to process faster. Yes, there are some new techniques, and yes, there's more data. So I think the ability to fuel AI, machine learning, et cetera, is much better than it was, you know, decades ago. We figured out how to integrate data. We have more data to use, and we have the computing power to do it. So yes, there are pockets of where, you know, AI has really proved just amazing, you know, like product recommendations and automating manufacturing and, you know, stock trading, for what it's worth, you know. But it's not something that I think is mainstream in most organizations. They're still trying to get out of that mode of where they're just using data to build pretty pie charts and dashing dashboards to actually put data to work as a real resource. So, there are skill problems. We get into the mode where, you know, everybody understands, you know, a dashboard and the data is simple to use. You don't need big data. You don't need complex algorithms. You don't need a lot of data integration to do that kind of stuff. And then once you get into the more advanced analytics up through and including AI, you get into this kind of scary black box world that, you know, business leaders are freaked out by. A lot of times. And so you really have to prove it with them before you can do that. And then we start to get into the issues of ethics, right? Have we built bias into these systems? And if we have, are we going to get ourselves into hot water reputationally or legally from that? So the whole issue of AI ethics is big, yeah.
So I think for wrapping this conversation up, as you can probably tell, both David and Doug have a great deal of experience and vision in this space. If you're in a leadership team at an organization looking to tackle a data problem, connect with either of them or myself on LinkedIn. I'm certain that they would be very happy to speak with you and share their expertise both in their relative areas of experience. And I also know that Doug has offered for leadership teams who are looking to tackle projects like this, that if you connect with him on LinkedIn and let him know you'd like to share some books with their executive leadership team, there's some copies available for that as well. So definitely feel free to reach out to these experts as well as myself and engage them in conversations as you're starting to move along in your journey or even get started on your data journey, and so that you can take advantage of their expertise. For today, thank you so much, both of you, for joining today's podcast, and we'll see at least David, I'm sure, in a future episode.
Doug, it's been a real honor.
Real pleasure, David. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you, too. Have a great afternoon. Thanks for listening to Data Unchained, powered by Hammerspace. To learn more, visit hammerspace.com. If you have a guest you would like to hear on the show, email me at molly@hammerspace.com.